Cindy, I'd love to. I know that this is all based in some way on the work of Raymond Moody and his near-death experiences. We now call them NDEs. People are very familiar with this. Can you describe that work?
Yeah, in fact, my title, Seven Questions About Life After Life, gives a nod to Raymond Moody, who was a pioneer in talking to people who had near-death experiences. These are experiences of people who actually are declared clinically dead or very, very near death in a coma, come back to report that there's this marvelous world on the other side that has loved ones on the other side and has all of this color and sound and the presence of God and love, and they come back to report on it.
They're oftentimes like they're brain dead. It's right. Not like a brain activity.
Right.
It's like the brain no longer filters out something in some way, and it just, they are able to pop into this other reality. It's quite amazing, isn't it?
It is, and Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, which came out in 1975, really opened the door for a lot of other researchers. There are tens of thousands of recorded NDE experiences that are archived, and something is going on. So there's a wonderful one by Mary Neal, who was a surgeon and kayaker, who died in a whitewater accident. And, she, as far as she was concerned, she was dead, except she went to this marvelous domed building and got all of this information with, that said, you must go back. You have more to do, which turns out to be at least writing two books, and To Heaven and Back, a doctor's extraordinary account of her death, heaven, angels, and life again, a true story. That's her first book. There are people who have written very eloquently about those experiences, and the one thing that comes through all of them is the lack of fear of death anymore. They know what it's like. They know that there's another existence.
Well, now that's an important point, and I think it's something that I grasp from the book with your collaboration, is that how helpful that is in these really very challenging times that we're in right now. And what does Francis say about these times and how we can hold them and how, what can be helpful to us in these perilous times?
Well, I don't think we have to, convince anybody that there are a lot of things going on, climate change and wars and autocrats taking over and all kinds of places. So the evidence is clear. What Francis suggests is that we need to put a larger frame on what's going on. And she said when things like that are about to happen, when the earth is about to reset, rebalance itself, and there's going to be a lot of chaos and turmoil, that people like me, like you, show up and say, wait a minute, there's a larger frame that we can put on this whole thing. These are just temporary lives. We, have existence beyond this space-time dimension. And those are very important messages to be carrying out right now.
And what is the action that we can take then? I mean, because we want to be of help, even if things are perilous and whatever the outcome, we don't know the actual outcome, and we want to be of help. And I think this is where Francis has told us that it's about kind of love, compassion, gratitude. Do you recall any of that?
Service, whatever service you're providing, and that could be, anything, practically everything we do is a service to the rest of the community. And be in the present moment. Just know that this too shall pass.
And it just reminds me of an example that you gave. There was a young boy who was like 6 years old. He was autistic, and he got lost in the woods. And something about that whole incident was helpful to you. Do you recall that story?
One of the things that Frances does in the book is to comment on contemporary news stories. And again, this is a collaboration between the two of us, so I'm sure that news story is in my head as much as hers. And she said there's going to be a lot of suffering, a lot of challenging situations that we're all going to face in the upcoming years. And I said, I'm a mess just listening to a story of a six-year-old autistic kid getting lost in the woods in South Carolina. You know, what am I going to do with a lot of suffering, you know? And she said, reframe the story.
And he died, actually.
Right. Yes. They found him dead, yeah. And she said, the mother was on TV, and we all gave her our love. We all connected with her because she was so distraught. 150 volunteers went out looking for this kid, and they found him dead. But there were 150 people that put themselves in service to that situation. And then he was found dead. And she says, as the end of it, that he's with us here now, and he's not this little lost autistic boy that was scared of being in the world.
So it gives some comfort there that brought people together. And oftentimes in disasters, that's when the best of us shows up. When, like here, you and I live in the Bay Area, we've had fires and earthquakes and other places. There are hurricanes and floods and all sorts of things. And it seems to bring out the best in certain people rather than the worst.
We could name experience after experience or story after story of the violence that's happening now, the horrible mass shootings that are going on, the kids in Parkland, Florida, yes. Christchurch in New Zealand, where somebody went in and just machine gunned a whole bunch of people. And it's horrible. It is just unbelievably bad. However, what happens is that thousands of people come together because of that incident. Look, the Parkland kids galvanized kids all over the country to march against gun violence, and that wouldn't have happened without Parkland. And that's the kind of point that Frances tries to make, and she always prefaces it by saying, you know, I'm not overlooking the pain and the grief and the horror of the situation, but look at it from a larger context. What happens? Thousands of people come in motion because of one incident.
Even though we don't know the outcome, just doing that act together somehow connects us with that love. I guess that's all I can say. It's like, and you started this whole program talking about love, and God is being described as that perfect love. In those moments, I feel we really come in contact with that energy.
Yeah.
And somehow the door doesn't ever quite close up again once we've experienced that. And it's usually coming out of doing some service to another. Is that your experience?
That's certainly my experience in my own work. I've been involved with social justice issues and anti-racism and all that practically all my life. And when things happen, you know, like a single murder of a black kid in somewhere else, I mean, it galvanizes all these people. We know that's not right. We know that we don't want to live in that kind of world. And something in us responds to that. And like you said, it's love. It's based on love. And I think that just adds to the collective consciousness at that point.
Did Frances say anything about the collective consciousness? Is it evolving? Is it evolving in good ways? Are we doing better than we have? Are we getting better as a species, or are we going downhill?
She won't commit to that. I've asked her that in 10 different ways, and she said, I don't know. I'm not privy to what's going to happen. I asked her, is this another extinction? You know, is our species done? And she said, I don't know. I think there still will be people, humans, to carry on, and hopefully they will carry on the best of us. But we don't know that yet for sure. And so I've asked her, you know, how many millions of people are going to die in these upcoming upheavals? She said, I don't know. I'm not privy to that kind of, vision of the future. So, you know, I don't have an answer to that. I just know that we're going to be into much more challenging situations in this next 10 years coming up.
So we can shrink when we hear that. We can kind of want to pull the covers up over our heads when we hear that, because it's not something we want to really think about or face. But through this book, The Seven Questions About Life After Life, it helps to kind of unclench our bodies and to relax a little more and to say, okay, hey, it's not pretty right now and it may get worse, but we're in it together and it won't be forever. That energy in life goes on is what this collaboration is really saying.
Absolutely. And one of the things that, I mean, I've learned a lot, and not everything she said was, you know, did I take at face value, you know, and say, oh, that must be true. One of them is we come in, we are born with a purpose. That one I've had to learn and get used to, and I can say now that I do accept that as a reality. But you and I came into this timing. Why did we come in right now? Why did we come in at the end of the 20th century and, you know, and do the work that we did? And it's because we knew that was going to happen. We wanted to be on hand for the chaos. Now, I don't know whether everybody's on board with that, but there were so many of us that planted the seeds of love and connection and community and harmony and respect for the earth in the second half of the 20th century. And that's because we knew what was coming up.
So, like you're saying, the incarnation, those of us, like, born since, I don't know, since 1940, let's say, or 39 or 35 or something, there are a whole bunch of people that have come in that knew that there was a life purpose, and that's to be here as, I think, use the phrase in the book, first responders.
Yeah.
And what did that mean to you?
I love that term because I think first responders means the, you know, the police and the fire people and the people that are responding to an emergency, like one of these mass shootings and all of those things. But I also see it as a kind of spiritual first responder as well. You know, we're there with the message that there's a larger picture going on here. This is not, you know, the awfulness of all of this should be framed by the sense that this is part of a cycle of Earth. The Earth rebalances, the Earth resets itself, and I think we'd agree that it's, you know, it's time for a reset, for sure.
And to do the best we can to be helpful and
right.
Make
exactly.
Helpful choices rather than being more of the problem. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Cynthia Spring, and she is the collaborator of a book with Dr. Frances Vaughn, Seven Questions About Life After Life, Book One. If you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, cindyspring.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Cindy Spring. She is the co-collaborator of a book with Dr. Frances Vaughn, Seven Questions About Life After Life, Book One. And Cindy, I'd like to talk about spirit guides. I often use that phrase for myself. I when I want to contact other realms, this invisible, I call it the invisible realm, and I ask for my guides and spirit guides to come to me. Am I just blowing smoke there? Is that real? Is that something that's really available?
From everything I've read, and certainly what Francis says, is that we all have spirit guides. When we're born, we get one assigned to us, and this is a more evolved spirit. But we can have two or three, and so they're there, but we have to ask them for help, and we also, sometimes when we ask them, they don't respond in the ways that we would like them to, and that's because they're more savvy about what our life purpose is. And say, for instance, if you get a diagnosis that's not, you know, that's troubling, and you say, could you please just get rid of this, you know, and that doesn't happen. But what does happen is you get through whatever the medical situation is, and you come out stronger and more conscious of the preciousness of life, all kinds of things of people who have come through cancer and other serious diseases. I'm just using that as an example. But spirit guides are there to, I think, prevent accidents from happening. I mean, you know how there are so many times when I should have been in an accident, you know, but something helped me see, oh, there was a person in the crosswalk, or that car was coming from the other side. And I've come to believe that that's spirit guides, you know, expanding our awareness to say, watch out, look out for that. And so that to me, and parking places, I have a spirit guide named Michael. And, I mean, it works. I can't tell you how wonderful it works. It just works. Michael gets me parking places in the most difficult, crowded places. It's a very low-level talent, but it's one that comes in handy sometimes. And Francis says, yes, we have spirit guides that help us all the way through our lives.
That just reminds me, Ben, what about suicide? So if we get a diagnosis or something, then for those who choose to take their own life and move out of it. What is said? Is there any comment made in the book or in?
Absolutely, both in book one and now coming up a little bit more in book two. I asked her about that, and she said, you know, some people's life purpose, their plan just didn't work out. They had unexpected circumstances. They got involved in an opioid addiction or something like that. It's just not working. I mean, that's one kind of choice, you know, to say, I'm out of here. It's not working out, and I'm going to try again another time. And the other one that I wrote about actually in Wave and Drop, there's a whole chapter on the right to death laws that are being passed. California has one now in place. And with the help of a doctor and a sign-off from, I think, a psychologist, you can decide to take your own life.
Only if you have a diagnosis.
That's
saying you have a limited time. It's
right.
Not just anybody can do it, but you've got, like, I think 6 months to live is what your diagnosis is, and then you might be able to tap into that, although that may change as time goes on.
Yeah, you know, it's surprising. It started in Oregon by a man named, I believe it was Peter Goodwin, and he was the promoter of that. It took him years and years to get it, but Oregon passed the first right-to-die laws in the country. He ended up using it himself, but during the first 12 years of its existence, only 1,000 people availed themselves. They expected thousands and thousands of people to use it, and it didn't happen that way, mm-hmm. And it's not happening here. And there was concerns that somebody was going to want the inheritance from the family or, you know, play some hanky-panky. None of that is happening, and very few people are actually doing it. So it's for extreme situations, and the good news is, according to Francis anyway, that there's no stigma. You know, you come back, you're accepted, you're part of the community and all of that. And, you know, you learned from it. You learned
you know,
from your experience.
In my personal experience with that, Michael's son took his own life. And his life became so difficult. It turned out we didn't know at the time he was bipolar. And we kept working with him psychologically. And it was before they really had a lot of medicines that would help to regulate someone in this situation. And when he took his life, he did it in a very, very conscious way. And in the way he did it, we were absolutely sure that He wrote a letter. He did everything, and all we could think about was, and we got some help, like with people like Helen Palmer and others who have this ability, psychic ability. He took a warrior's way out in that way. Mm-hmm. That it's not easy to do, to decide to do that, mm-hmm. but in some way we miss him tremendously. But it is a choice in some ways. And, yeah. and if it's done in such a way where you're left with, it's not like jumping off a bridge and suddenly you say in the middle of your fall, oh, I wish I hadn't have done this. It wasn't like that. It was very conscious. And I not that I'm advocating this, but somehow it was a comfort. And we looked at it as a warrior's way in some way, like you say, to reset his life, to start again in without that difficult circumstance.
I think that's lovely, and I think that what you're saying is you're looking at his situation, okay, rather than your situation. You're feeling grief. You're feeling guilt. Perhaps you should have done something you didn't do. Okay, it's his situation, and you've got to honor the fact that that was his choice.
Exactly, exactly. So, going on and moving on from suicide as we come to the close of our conversation, I would like for you to share with us anything that you can say about intuition that was very important to Frances when she was alive. Her Awakening Intuition was one of her books, and it was very important. What did she have to say, and what do you know and feel about intuition?
The fourth question of the Seven Questions book is, what are the portals? What are the ways that we can experience the greater reality? And number one, she talks about intuition because she was very familiar with it and had studied it. You know, this sense, you know, it's not a left brain sense that you worked it out and thought about it. It's something that comes to you that you feel, oh, there may be something right about this, or I should pay attention to this. And so that's the opening of the door of intuition. That moves right into psychic abilities, which the people who study them say we all have. Stephen Schwartz and Russell Targ and all these people with their wonderful books, you know, say we all have them. It's an aptitude, just like, and it's distributed in the species, which is nice to know. And we also talk about other kinds of portals that people can use to access the greater reality. Some like psychic abilities, experimenting with out of body kinds of things. But you know, we have tried and true ones also, like art and poetry and beautiful sunsets. And those can be opening doors for the greater reality as well. So each person has to find the best portal for themselves to get beyond the sense that we're in some kind of box, some kind of space-time box.
And I would say that with intuition, it may not come to us just straight on like a Mack yeah. truck, you know, and just kind of blast us out like, oh, we get this great idea and it comes bubbling up in full Technicolor. But it might be just something like a bird moving yeah. out of a garden, something out of the corner of your eye, something catches your eye and you notice it. And that's where I think Frances would say, follow that, even if it's just kind of small, follow that. Is that your experience?
Absolutely, yeah. Once you start working with it, you really get the difference between thinking and intuition. You know, intuition is another sense, like seeing and tasting and hearing. You know, it's just simply another sense. It's a sense modality in which information comes in, but you're not thinking about it. You're simply maybe posing a question, you know, and should I do this or should I do that? What should I do? You know, and just be quiet and allow it to show up rather than think it through.
So, again, you're saying it's getting out of that analytical mind,
right,
which we've developed to the nth degree. And so it's starting to train ourselves to access another part of ourselves.
Right. In fact, Frances, who was considered very, very bright, very smart, I'm sure she had a very high intellectual IQ, says several times, she said, the analytical mind is really overrated.
Well, it certainly has taken us far and maybe further than we really needed to go.
Well, it's out of balance, I think, is what she would say.
Yeah, the balance. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So can you share with us anything here at the end of our conversation about what you would like people to receive, what gift you would like people to receive from this book and this collaboration?
I asked Frances at the end, and I put it in the epilogue, what's the one-liner, what's the one message that you would like our book to communicate? And it's the same message that she opened up with, which is, death is a transition. Death is a transition. We are souls, and we have bodies that express themselves in space-time, and then the bodies go on their way and disappear, go back into the earth. We are souls, and we are immortal and inviolate, and we are part of the beloved community.
Beautiful. So thank you so much. That really wraps it up in such a beautiful way. Thank you so much, Cindy, for being with us today on New Dimensions.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Cindy Spring. She is a collaborator with Dr. Frances Vaughn of the book Seven Questions About Life After Life, Book One. And if you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, cindyspring.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3688.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. This program was recorded at Strawberry Hill Productions, a full-service podcast production studio in Novato, California. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org, or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby, where you can engage with us via our website at cjsf.ca or on our social media, which is CJSF Radio on TikTok and Blue Sky, or CJSF Music and CJSF Talk on Instagram.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections.
Many people worry about climate change and want to take action in their communities. So the University of Minnesota Extension's Community Climate Leaders Program brings people together to explore ways to make a difference.
A lot of people come in who want to connect with other people and want to feel like they're not alone in being as worried and concerned as they are about climate.
Christy Marsden oversees the program, which launched this year. Participants take 5 online lessons and meet 4 times as a group. They learn how climate change affects Minnesota. They read the Climate Action Handbook, which provides a list of 100 different climate solutions, and they discuss ways to engage others in these efforts. Then participants complete a project based on their interests, like finding ways to avoid driving to work or planting a rain garden to help absorb runoff and reduce flooding.
Really focusing on what strengths do you have? What motivates you? What passions do you have? Because being passionate about it and being motivated are the only ways we're going to make it sustainable for as long as we need to be doing it.
Marsden says she gets excited watching people turn their anxiety and despair about climate change into hope and action together.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.